Not only won't Dolly go away again, but she will be here in spirit, in the person of Richard Skipper, who is with us in person, thank goodness.
Can you believe it?
Thank you, Sunrise Highway.
Yes, absolutely.
So, welcome. Welcome
thank you.
To the...
It's good to be here, finally.
When did you actually set out? Was it about 9:30 at night?
I think that we left... I live in Rockland County, and I think we left our house probably around 8:45 to get here on time.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I mean, you did get rather lost. I mean, did you...
Absolutely.
Stony Brook... I know, as I said, I do another program on a Stony Brook radio station. So that is, like, way north, and also several miles east.
I took the scenic route.
Yeah, except it was dark.
Absolutely.
So you hadn't seen anything. But anyway, welcome
to... Thank you. It's great to be here.
Days Gone By. Now, Richard, let's do a little bit of the bio stuff. You are a two-time winner of the MAC Award.
Which is the Manhattan Association of Cabarets and Clubs.
Which you're also involved with in a certain...
I am on the board of directors. I was vice president for a year, but because of my schedule, I've stepped down. I'm still on the board, but I'm no longer the vice president.
Okay. And it's funny because we also had, just a few weeks ago, Barry Levitt, who's the fellow who's conducting her song.
Yeah, absolutely.
So he was talking a lot about Max stuff.
He was the president for a while, and Barry and I actually worked together years ago. Barry used to do the Lyrics and Lyricists series at the 92nd Street Y.
Mm-hmm.
And when he did his tribute to Julie Stein, of course, Julie Stein, did Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, I was one of the guest stars in that show.
As
Carol Channing.
Oh, right.
Yes.
So did you have some of the issues with the Max that he has, or has it been a good thing for the most part?
Well, I think that Mac is on the right track. I think that with any type of an organization, there are always growing pains. And the interesting thing is that finally it's been the voting as far as the board is turned over to the membership.
Mm-hmm.
But the term is 2 years, and then the membership can re-vote, or, you know, and we're still debating on what we're going to be doing with term limits. But as far as you get into a stride, and then it's election time again.
Yeah, I mean, 2 years is a very short to accomplish.
Absolutely.
Although, let's face it, I think we all wish George Bush is
We're only without 2 years. Saying, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, come on, you can make fun of George Bush. I mean, we're not going to make fun of Carol Channing here, but
we're not
going to
make
fun
of Carol
Bush.
Channing, but we'll make fun of George Bush.
Thank you. Thank goodness.
And, of course, Carol has had her own political issues. She was on Nixon's enemy hate list, which she said was one of the greatest honors of her life.
Now, how did she get on Nixon's hate list?
Well, Hello Dolly had opened. Hello Dolly was one of the, it was the biggest hit. It was, in its time, what The Producers is now.
Okay.
Nixon actually wanted to campaign with the Hello Dolly song as a campaign song. But Lyndon Johnson ended up doing it, and Carol sang, "Be our guide, Lyndon, Lady Bird by your side, Lyndon," and she toured around the country, and he won, we knew that he won when he won, too.
So, in other words, and that's why Nixon...
Then shortly after that, Carol did perform at the White House for Nixon and Pat, and she gave Pat one of her diamonds, and the next day, she was on the enemy hate list. She said either he didn't like my singing or he just had the diamond appraised. I don't know.
Man. But did she have hard feelings for him?
No. I mean...
How do you find out you're actually on a hate list like that?
It was... the Nixon enemy hate list was a big thing, and there were many, many people.
But who disclosed it? Was it like a Woodward and Bernstein thing, or did it just...
No, it was out there. It was something that was out there in the open. Joan Namath, and I don't know the reasons why, was actually on Nixon's enemy hate list.
Long hair.
Maybe that was it, or wearing pantyhose. Who knows?
Right.
But Carol used to joke that she was above Joan Namath for obvious reasons, alphabetically, and it was something that they both were very proud of.
Good heavens. Now let's, since we're talking to you at this stage,
right.
And then Peter will talk to Carol, but first of all, you were doing, I assume, other kinds of things in entertainment and in performing before
absolutely.
The impersonation, and during as well.
Right.
But how did that all come about, of shifting from being Richard Skipper singer, Richard Skipper actor.
Do we have a week on this? I'll try to give you the Reader's Digest version and interrupt me and, you know, and ask questions as we go along. But I was the kind of kid, I grew up in South Carolina, who mimicked everything I saw on television. And my introduction to Carol Channing was actually through Lucille Ball. Lucille Ball, in one of the episodes of The Lucy Show, does an impersonation of Carol Channing. And I was mimicking my version of Lucille Ball doing Carol Channing. And then it was shortly after that that I saw Carol do a television special, Carol Channing and Pearl Bailey, live on Broadway.
Right.
And I became a fan. And I never actually pursued this, but I was the kind of kid, as I said, who was always mimicking these voices.
Right.
And so I was performing at assemblies. I would get up and I would do different voices, and Carol Channing was one of the voices that I did. And then I moved to New York when I was 18 years
old. I'm going to stop you there, because did you get beaten up a lot? I mean, it's one thing to make fun of the principal.
But especially in South Carolina. I was the first one laughing. They laughed with me and instead of laughing at me. I was a very popular kid in school.
Huh.
I was everyone in the kids knew me, in the school knew me. As a matter of fact, a few years ago, I went back to my hometown to do my show, Carol Channing in Concert. I was given the key to the city by the mayor of my hometown, and a friend of mine that I went to high school was interviewed by one of the local papers, and she said there were the rich kids, there were the poor kids, there were farm kids, there were the city kids. There were the bookworms, there were the kids that never studied, the delinquents that were always in trouble, and then there was Richard. She said Richard was in a category by himself. But there wasn't a person in my high school who did not know who I was. So I was that kid who was always out there. I started acting when I was 13. I made my debut in a Jerry Herman musical, MAME, as Patrick Dennis.
Okay.
And I did a lot of theater.
Oh, wait, when you say you made you're not talking about high school anymore. You're talking about you were in MAME where?
In a community theater in South Carolina. And I did a lot of theater. I was auditioning for everything. And my parents always said that as long as I maintained my grades, they had no problem with that. And I was out there, and I was in the National Honor Society. I worked very hard at it, and I continued to pursue a career. And I was reading a book one day when I was doing MAME, just an interesting story here. True story. I was reading a book, and it says, make up your mind what you're going to do with your life and do it. And I announced to the cast that 5 years from that date that I was going to move to New York. And on August 5th of 1979, I moved to New York at the age of 18 to pursue a career in the theater. And I was in New York for just a little bit of time. Some friends of mine came up to visit. There used to be a place in New York called the Piano Bar, which was at 67th and Broadway.
Was that Bemelman's or no? No,
no, it was in Charlie O's, I think it was.
Okay.
Houston Allred, who is still going strong now on the West Coast, was the piano player there. And every Thursday night was Broadway night. And they would salute a different Broadway show. And the cast of the shows would come in, and they would sign autographs, and they would get up and sing. And I would get up and sing each week as Richard. It was an open mic type of situation. And my friends were visiting, and they said, you should and Houston asked me to do an encore. And I said, I don't have anything prepared. And my friends said, well, do Carol Channing. And he said, you do Carol Channing? No, you have to realize I was 18 years old. And I said, no, I don't do Carol Channing, because this was not something that I was pursuing, and I certainly didn't want to do it in front of an audience, because I really didn't think that it was fun to do it for my friends, but to do this in a professional setting, I didn't think that I was ready to do that. But I got up, I performed as Carol Channing, doing the entire Hello Dolly number, and got a standing ovation, and as a result of that, I ended up getting cast in an off-Broadway show where I played an impersonator who does Carol Channing, and then, and I'm jumping way ahead of the story, and I had a costume, and I would pull it out on Halloween, and I would hit all the piano bars, and I would go out and perform, and I would just come in, do a number, and leave.
Well, let me ask, also, by the way, if you could just not hit that table so much, because it's actually coming through on the mic, but about the, have you seen, well, you probably saw the original Chorus Line. I don't know if you've seen the most recent revival.
I haven't seen the recent, but I did see the original.
So, Was it kind of like the depiction there? I didn't remember this about Coruscant at all, but the most troubled, quote-unquote, kid, is the most horrible thing for him was the fact that he started doing female impersonations, and
well,
that he felt it was seamy. But
I really avoided it for a long, long time because there are so many negative connotations that go with this. If we can talk on this for a moment, I perform all over the country. I know I'm jumping ahead of my story, but I perform all over the country. I have performed everywhere from Carnegie Hall across the boards. As I've said to you earlier, I don't make fun of Carol. I treat her with the utmost respect. Now, the thing with, I don't even like to call myself an impersonator, because most people who are doing an impersonation are actually making fun of their subject. They are actually filtering their subject through their eyes. And 9 times out of 10, they are presenting what they've seen other impersonators do. A perfect example, throw me an icon.
Mercedes McCambridge.
Just been your do the devil voice from The Exorcist or something. I mean, someone who is overly impersonated.
Bob Dylan. Okay.
Betty Davis.
Oh, Betty. Okay.
Now Betty Davis. Every impersonator is flicking the cigarette around, and they're doing, you know, these movements and things that they've picked up mostly from Charles Pierce, who was well known for doing his Betty Davis, and what happens is, as this goes on with impersonator after impersonator after impersonator doing the person that they are impersonating, they're getting further and further away from their subject. And that subject ends up becoming a parody or a clown type of figure. Carol Channing is a bigger-than-life personality.
True.
I don't need to embellish anything beyond what she has created on stage. What I try to do, which is very different from what most impersonators do, is I try to get into the heart and soul of what made this person a great entertainer. I try to present her on stage to the best of my ability, because I am not Carol Channing, to the best of my ability. My goal each time that I walk out on stage is to give the audience the experience that I've had each time that I have sat watching Carol Channing perform.
Well, can you put into words what makes her so special and unique?
I can absolutely put into words. What makes her special and unique is this bond that she has with her audience. It's not about special effects. It's not about chandeliers falling. It's not about fog rolling in, Klieg lights rolling. It's about a bond between her and her audience. When she walks on stage, her number one goal is to entertain that audience. It's not about her. It's about the audience. And to blow my own horn for a moment, I think I carry that same gift. When I walk out on stage, my entire reason for being there is to entertain my audience. I've always said there are entertainers and there are performers. I want to put myself in the former category. I want to entertain the audience as much as I possibly can. I want them to forget their problems. I want them to be to escape what's going on in the real world. I don't talk about politics in my show. I don't talk about what's going on in the real world. I take them on a journey with me.
Inside, everything is beautiful.
That's right.
It's the basic thing. Before we have to kind of let you go to bring Carol, quotation marks in my fingers, in, might as well tell how then that synced up with your first being able to meet her in person.
Well, I found out in, this was in 80, well, it was the last time she was doing Dolly on Broadway, so this was 94. It had been announced that Hello Dolly was coming to Broadway, and several of my friends said that you should do a show to do a tribute to Carol. I didn't know whether audiences would be interested in seeing, again, an impersonation, for lack of a better word, of Carol Channing when they could see the real thing. But I began doing research. I began studying her beyond Hello Dolly and beyond Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. I began putting this show together, and then I found out that the New York City Gay Men's Chorus was going to be honoring Jerry Herman at Carnegie Hall. So I started a campaign to get into that show. I thought this would be a way of bringing to the masses what I do. I wrote letters. I made phone calls. I begged. I pleaded. I cajoled. Everything landed on deaf ears. They were not interested in doing this. So a friend of mine called me up, said, what are you doing on Sunday night, the night of the concert? He said, I have been hired to perform at the post party for Carol Channing. He said, why don't you show up at the party as Carol Channing?
Wow.
I said, well, I don't know. What if she doesn't like me? He says, well, then you know where you stand with it. And I had the feeling, I didn't have as much invested at that time as I obviously do now, but if she didn't like what I was doing, I could just chuck it all and continue pursuing my career again because I had taken this little curve in the road, putting this show together. I walked into this room dressed as Carol. Carol was sitting at the end of the table. They brought me to her table, and they says, Carol, where did you learn to do this? And Carol asked me, where did you learn to do this? And I said, Bennington College in Vermont. You do know where that is, Carol? It's the lower left-hand corner part of the map, the part of the state that's always purple, which, of course, is her material. So she said, well, how long have you been impersonating me? I said, well, who's to say you're not impersonating me? And we were off and running. She asked me a lot of questions. I ended up doing my show that night for her. She said that it was the first time that she had ever been shown by an impersonator with respect. And I asked her permission to open the show. She said, take the gauntlet and run with it. I opened the show in New York at Don't Tell Mama.
Oh, yeah.
As a result of doing that show, I got booked in Atlantic City. I've done three long runs in Atlantic City. I was off and running, and I've been doing it full time ever since.
So full time, you don't do anything than Richard Skipper sings Bowie
Exactly. When I am not on stage performing as Carol Channing, the rest of my life is devoted to pursuing the work. Still, at this point, my phone doesn't ring off the hook, but I work a lot. I even teach workshops on making a living on the road, teaching other performers who have self-contained acts how to go about it the way that I do.
Hmm.
Because, and the reason that my phone doesn't ring off the hook are, you know, various reasons. First of all, people do have a preconceived idea of what my show is about.
It's not as if they're going to hire you for Raisin in the Sun.
Exactly. Or, but the straight venues are afraid that they're going to get a drag show, which scares them off, and that's not what my show is. And then the gay venues feel that Carol Channing is not a quote-unquote contemporary icon, and so they're more interested in seeing the Chairs and the Madonnas and the Whitney Houstons, and so I'm constantly having to sell myself.
There are Whitney Houston impersonators?
There are a lot of Whitney Houston impersonators. You'd be surprised.
Okay.
Probably more than there are Carol Channing impersonators. But those are the issues that I run into on a regular basis. So I have learned to be a great salesman in terms of selling the show.
And again, before we bring in you as Carol, where are you going to be over the next, say, March and April?
Well, I'm doing a benefit at the 12 Miles West Theater in Montclair, New Jersey, later this month.
Mm-hmm.
This will be my third time there. I do a lot of repeat business. And then I'm bringing my show back to New York for one night only for Sylvia's Place, which is a shelter for teenagers in New York. And I'm doing a benefit, and this will be at Helen's. And if I may throw out, my web address is www.richardskipper.com.
Don't throw out the web address. It's a perfectly good web address.
No, and they can go to my schedule page, and they can see where I'm appearing.
Richardskipper.com.
Or they can book me.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
That's true.
So we have booked Richard Skipper and Richard as Carol, and I've also booked Peter Fitzgerald to come here and talk to the icon, or the icon in quotation marks, kind of, however you want to put it. Stick around.
The legend within the legend. Well,
thank you. Yes, the legend within the legend. It's kind of like those things you had when you were a kid where you shaped things out of clay and then you chipped away at it and then the actual statue was inside.
That's right.
That's exactly what we're doing here on Dave's Gone By, so do not change that dial.
Well, hello, Aru. Oh, I'm so thrilled. I'm so happy. I'm so excited. Ladies and gentlemen, this is I am... What's the Jewish word for this? Kvelling, I think it is.
Oh, verklempt?
Verklempt is when you're sad. Verklempt is when you're upset. It's like, oh, I broke a nail. Then I get verklempt.
Oh, that would be something that would affect Barbara Streisand a lot.
Well, you mentioned, the sacred word, Barbara, I love you.
Oh,
but I love you too.
Yes. Well, she did the movie version of Hello, You Know Who.
Were you upset about that?
Yeah, well, it was like my baby had been kidnapped. I have to tell you, I was appearing in Chicago, and I read, just like the rest of the world, that Barbara Streisand was going to be doing the movie version of Hello, Dolly. And, well, even though I was on the first floor, I almost jumped out the window.
Oh, my, you had a Marnie Nixon moment. I've had those. I know how they feel.
Although, I will say this, although I don't feel that she was right for the role, nobody could sing those songs like Barbara Streisand. She has a voice of God. I mean, it is an angel's voice. Don't you agree?
Well, yes, I'm a Barbara fan, aren't we all?
Yes, except when the only time I ever got airsick, I was going to Europe, France, and the in-flight movie was Hello, Dolly.
Well, did you grab a parachute and say, let me off this plane?
Well, if I
put on Mildred Pierce.
I could have gotten off at that moment, I would have gotten off.
Oh, my
goodness. And she should have gotten off as well.
Well. But have you ever met her? Have you had tea and crumpets and what
no,
stars do?
No, tea and crumpets. But I do respect her as an artist. I think she is one of the best in the business, and I have nothing but respect for her.
Now here's another person. Since we're talking about stars and other famous and important people,
yes,
I would love to know your thoughts about David Merrick. The producer, the big, bad, nasty
man,
whom helped make
David
the star.
Well, David Merrick, some of your listeners out there may be too young to know who David Merrick was. David Merrick was a great Broadway impresario. He could make or break a career with a single chomp on his cigar. He had an office in New York that was all red. It was like going into. It was like going to see the devil when
My
you went
goodness.
To see him. But I had nothing but respect for him. David Merrick saw me. I was doing The Millionaires in an arena, believe it or not, George Bernard Shaw, and he came to see the show, and he says, Carol, we're going to get a show for you. And he believed in me. You know, Hello, Dolly was written for Ethel Merman.
That's right.
Yes, but David Merrick saw Ethel Merman, God bless her, did not want to do the show at that moment, and David Merrick sought me out, and he asked, he said, we're going to create something for you. And he brought me to Jerry Herman and to Gower Champion. Gower Champion had been the director choreographer of Lyndon Ear, which was the show that brought me to New York and made me a star.
We'll talk about Van Gogh. No, I'm joking there.
I know it is. Yes, I get it. Well, anyway, Lyndon Ear was the show that brought me to the attention of Julie Stein and Anita Loose, of course, and I did Gentlemen Prefer Blondes as a result of that. But Gower Champion did not think that I was right for Dolly Levi, and so I had to audition for it, just like anyone else auditioning for something. And I came, you see, I had a very big hit with Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and then I did a lot of work, but I couldn't get my own show. I couldn't get back on track, so I went through a very dry period. And
That's what they make KY for, darling. Good heavens. No, I kid. I joke.
Yes.
Please continue.
But they really thought that I was not right for the role, and I came in, and I auditioned for Jerry and for Gower Champion, and I did the Money Is Like Manure speech.
Yeah. Please do. You must do it.
Well,
you must.
Money, if you'll pardon the expression, is like manure. It's not worth a thing unless it's spread around encouraging young things to grow. And I did the speech, and all of a sudden, they knew at that moment that I knew exactly what Dolly Levi was about. And it was at that moment that they decided to give me the role.
Oh, my goodness. Did you know while you were doing it that the moment when you came down the staircase would be legendary? Or while you were doing the scene in rehearsals, did it just seem like another exciting kind of scene, but no big deal?
Absolutely not. If I believed at that moment that this, what I was going to do was going to be legendary, or that it was going to make history, or that I was a legend, I would become a very boring person, don't you think? No, we were there to create this role, and when we opened in Detroit, we were all over the place. I mean, we got the most devastating reviews. I think the first night the show ran about 4.5 hours. They thought the show was going to be such a bomb. The first act of Hello, Dolly ended with a butterfly ballet. Can you believe this?
Oh, heaven.
The show at that moment was about Gower Champion. I'm sorry, it was about Horace Vandegelder, And it was about Minnie Faye. It was about Cornelius Hackle. It was about everything but Dolly Levi. And once Jerry Herman got into the mindset of Thornton Wilder, who wrote The Matchmaker, upon which this is based, he found the spine of Hello, Dolly. And the spine of Hello, Dolly is about rejoining the human race, about saying, I am going to get out there, I'm going to pull myself up by my bootstraps, and I'm going to get out there and do it again. And once he did that, we had Dolly Levi, and we started at the National Theater in Washington, D.C. We brought the show to New York, and the rest is history.
Well, I think that's what people don't realize about that song, because they hear it everywhere, from Louis Armstrong to people doing it all the time. They don't realize that the point is, it's the first time she's been back at that club since her husband died.
Oh,
so it's a very important play.
It's very, very interesting, and this is how Broadway has really changed. Louis Armstrong took that song, and he made it into a New Orleans jazz arrangement. And this was before we had become famous with the show. And when Jerry Herman heard the song, he said, well, that's not exactly what I wrote, but I love it nonetheless. And everybody came to the show in New York to hear that song that Louis Armstrong had made famous. It knocked the Beatles clear off the charts.
Is Jerry Herman your best friend? I get this feeling that you have this kinship.
Jerry Herman is my solar plexus.
That's a little closer than
Jerry
I thought.
Jerry Herman is two people in one, because he is a lyricist and a composer. He gave me Dolly Levi on a platter. And, let's face it. I mean, he wrote the show for Ethel Merman, and this clarion voice in the theater that was going to belt these songs to the back of the theater. And then I come in with this basso profundo voice, and, every song that Jerry wrote, you know, he wrote with his mother in mind.
I did not know that.
His mother was an entertainer, and he always thought of his mother when he was composing and writing every song. And he always said to me, Carol, I'm going to make this sound exactly the way that it should sound with your voice. So he brought in the oboes, and he brought in these instruments that would bring my voice down, and it would make this sound that was, you know, like from like the Lower East Side of New York. And that's where we created Dolly Levi. And it was so magical. But every person that came to do the show, and there was Ginger Rogers and Betty Grable and B.B. Osterwald and Phyllis Diller and Martha Ray and Pearl Bailey and Mary Martin and Ethel Merman, they all brought their own personalities to it. But I can always say that I opened that door.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, my goodness. I'm shivering just thinking of doors opening in my head. But let me ask you, though, that song, that show, it's you. It will always be identified with you. You must be. You're so proud. You're so thrilled. Let me ask, please. Do you ever kind of get tired of having to sing it every single time? Like, you're always asked, oh, hello, postman. Oh, hello, oncologist. Do you sometimes just want to do Before the Parade Passes By instead? Or maybe a Beatles tune. I don't know.
I never get tired of that song. I always tell people I never sing Hello, Dolly. It was the chorus boys that sang Hello, Dolly. I sang Hello, Harry, Hello, Louie. But the thing is, no, I never get tired of that song. Every time that I go out on stage, it's a different experience. It's not the same experience. Everyone who comes into the theater, I've always said that in order for a show to be successful, you need people from different walks of life. If you had an audience made up all of postmen, it would be boring because they all think the same way. But when you've got a postman in the audience, and you've got a doctor, and you've got a lawyer, and you've got an Indian chief and a candlestick maker, you've got all these people in the
audience. Sounds like my last party. Yeah.
Yes. Well, each of these people brings their own lives into that experience. When the curtain rises on a show, that's the magic of live theater. Those people that are brought as a collective to celebrate this are not the same as the people that were there last night, nor will they be the same as the people that are there tomorrow night. It's a different experience. So each time that I get an opportunity to sing these songs, I'm absolutely thrilled to do so.
Oh, that's so great to hear, because we love hearing you, well, Carol and U.S. Carol doing them, of course. Let me ask, I'll put it a little more towards the personal side here. Now that everybody is so concerned about anorexic models and the way people are eating and bulimia and anorexia, you were eating strange little things for years.
Well, most people don't know this, but when I was doing Hello Dolly in 1964, I was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. Most people don't know this. I was doing the show. I was actually going through chemo and everything at the time, and I had to be put, and of course, I'm a Christian Scientist. My father, George Channing, was a lecturer and a newspaperman. He was the editor-in-chief of all of the Christian Science publications. He worked with Mary Baker Eddy. He traveled around the country. So in order for me to be able to deliver, to be on stage night after night after night, I had to be very careful with the foods that I ate. So I was very, very, I studied what would be the right combinations of food. I was doing this long before it became fashionable to do so. I was, so when I would go out to restaurants, a lot of them were happy to have me there. So I would go in with my own food, and I would bring it in, and I would eat it. But now, you know, I've passed all that. I can eat whatever I want.
Oh, yeah.
I'm partial to Subway sandwiches. I love Subway sandwiches. And every once in a while, I even have a cheeseburger.
No.
Oh, yes.
I would give every penny I own to watch you eat a cheeseburger.
Oh, I'm sure you would.
Oh, heavens to mercy. And let me ask, you're married once more?
Yes, I married Harry Collegian, who is my high school sweetheart.
Oh.
You see, you have to know this, that I had been in another marriage. I had three other marriages, but they don't count. And then I had written a memoir of sorts called Just Lucky, I guess. Now, I know you're wondering why I named the book Just Lucky, I guess. Well, it's like the client says to the prostitute, how did you get into a profession like this? Just lucky, I guess. And that was the title of my book, because I have been the luckiest person in the world. I've worked with the most wonderful people in show business. I've had an incredible career. But something that you never forget is your first love. And I wrote about my first love in this book, Harry Collegian, and a mutual friend of ours called him up, told him about the book, and all of a sudden, Harry Collegian got in touch with me, and we spoke on the phone. We got together 3 weeks later. He proposed, and we've been together ever since.
Oh, I wish you a mazel tov. I'm not even Jewish, but I'm wishing you a mazel tov anyway.
Thank you.
Oh, this is so great. Now, unfortunately, I've got to give the microphone back to Dave in a minute or two.
I have so enjoyed this.
You have to sing it for me. Please, Peter, or yes. Dave, or both of us, however you want to do it. Just please, and thank you so much, by the way, both Carol and Richard, and Richard is Carol, and Glenn is Carol, and
if
Richard,
I can just leave one
and Bob
thing,
and Carol, and Peg and Alice, yes.
What is so wonderful about doing this is we're live here, and there's nothing like live theater, and my life has become about the live theater, and I have set up the Dr. Carol Channing Harry Collegian Foundation for the Arts, and it's to raise money for funding for all the schools and universities so that every kid in the state of California who wants to pursue a career in the arts can do so. They can find a link on Richard Skipper's website, www.richardskipper.com, and that will take them right to my website as well, which is www.carolchanning.org.
CarolChanning.org, RichardSkipper.com, DavesGoneBy.org. Such wonderful websites, and of course, KinkyMen.com, but I'll go into
that's
that later.
That's another thing.
That's totally other thing. So sing to me, please. Please sing to me. Oh, please, and thank you again.
Goodbye, Peter. Well, goodbye, David. It was nice to be here in Babylon, finally, at last. We almost didn't make it, but we made it.
I am so thrilled. Thank you. Bless you. Thank you, Glenn. You were rather quiet. Say something, Glenn.
Something.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more of Dave's Gone By.
Just love you. Thank you so much, and keep it up.
Well, we'll go there too. Bye now.
Goodbye.